Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 384, Between Iraq and a Hard Place, part four. This is being recorded on October 20th of the year 2002. We're going to continue our examination of the circumstances surrounding Iraq, the very complex and sadly oversimplified and badly oversimplified situation vis-a-vis Iraq, and we're going to present some of the agonizing dilemmas that the United States finds itself in, to a large extent of its own creation, I would add. First, let me remind you that within a week or so of the airing of this broadcast, there will be a detailed article-length annotated description of For the Record program 384, featuring long excerpts of text. That will be in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, and it will have its own file. Also be aware that sister station WFMU-FM in New Jersey is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent shows are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older shows for download only at a longer URL linked to both the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website. Now, resuming a line of analysis that we have presented in various ways over the various broadcasts over the years, we're going to take a look at some of the arming of Saddam Hussein with his weapons of mass destruction, and we're going to take a look at the German role in that. And beyond that, of course, as veteran listeners will no doubt anticipate, we're going to be taking a look at the role of the Bormann Organization, the corporate underground post-war extension of the Third Reich. That'll sound like a crazy concept, but it's well documented, and there is abundant evidence of this in presented in the various For the Record programs, including For the Record 305, that has much of the documentation about the Bormann Organization from Paul Manning's remarkable text. The anti-American card figured prominently in the recent German election, in which Gerhard Schroeder's government was able to position itself as the advocate of peace and sanity vis-a-vis George Bush's lunacy, and I think that particular analysis is half right. I think the latter half of that is absolutely accurate. As I mentioned in For the Record 380, if one looks at the German power structure, their military, their intelligence community, many of their politicians, and in particular their corporations, they are the direct descendants of and extension of the Third Reich. And the Iraqi situation vis-a-vis Saddam Hussein not only was the beneficiary of German and Nazi activity, but Saddam Hussein has a Third Reich heritage. His uncle and political mentor, Khairullah al-Tufah, was a supporter of the Ali Rashid uprising on behalf of the Third Reich against the British in 1941. And indeed, Khairullah al-Tufah was the head of the Iraqi Biological Warfare Program, the General Directorate of Veterinary Affairs. Time permitting, I'm going to give a thumbnail synopsis of the many dilemmas vis-a-vis Iraq. To make a long story short, I think the United States is being has been maneuvered into a situation in which we are damned if we do and damned if we don't. I believe that we are walking into a trap that was laid from a geopolitical standpoint, probably during the closing stages of World War II, certainly afterward. And I think that this is a very, very dangerous situation. I believe that the Underground Reich, which is a reality, the Third Reich went underground. It wants to destroy and or subjugate the United States, to exterminate world Jewry, and to wipe out most of the Arabs as well, even though they profess to be the Arabs' allies. In fact, white supremacists and Nazis are virulently anti-Arab, and Hitler referred to the Arabs as, quote, lacquered half-apes who ought to be whipped, unquote. Well, how do you wipe out or subjugate the United States, exterminate the Jews, and wipe out most of the Arabs without appearing to be the bad guys? Well, you set up a situation in which the United States and Israel will fight against the entire Muslim world, the Arabs in particular. They will be wiped out and or fatally wounded in the case of the United States. They will in turn exterminate or wipe out most of the Arab world. And meanwhile, the Germans and the underground Reich can sit on the sideline and profess to be innocent. Consider that possibility. Also bear in mind the serpent's walk scenario that I've spoken about in the past. I will come back to that later. Now, in numerous programs, we've spoken about the Bormann and German link to the equipping of Saddam Hussein with his weapons of mass destruction. For the record, 87. For the record, 287. And for the record, number 295 deal with that, as does for the record number 380 and the other Between Iraq and a Hard Place series. There is a new film that is spotlighting the German role in helping to equip Saddam Hussein with his nuclear capability. Article about that appeared in the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, October 14th of 2002. This is an AP story, Dateline New York, by Charles J. Hanley. It's headlined by the Examiner, Saddam's Nuclear Link. Subtitled, Film Says German Helped Build Bombs. It reads, a new investigative film traces the roots of Iraq's nuclear capacity to links between German industry and Baghdad's bomb builders and questions the lenient sentence handed a German engineer for treason in aiding that project. The documentary, Stealing the Fire, offers a rare close-up look at a proliferator, unquote, the engineer Karlheinz Schaub, who emerges on film as a bland, gray, fastidious 68-year-old technician who protests he's too small to be turned into a scapegoat for the others, unquote. Blueprints and other documents Schaub and associates brought to Iraq in the 1980s, along with Schaub's own hands-on skills, were a vital boost to Baghdad's development of gas centrifuges, machines whose ultra-fast spinning enriches uranium by separating U-235, the stuff of nuclear bombs, from non-fissionable U-238. In an interview, Schaub says that on his last Baghdad visit in April of 1990, he personally helped install Iraq's first test centrifuge. In 1999, a German court convicted Schaub of treason and sentenced him to 5 years imprisonment and a $32,000 fine, but suspended that term because he previously served 15 months in a Brazilian jail. The light sentence raised questions. David Albright, who was on the UN inspection team, said, quote, I think they wanted the Schaub story to disappear. It was intensely embarrassing, unquote. Well, indeed, the Schaub story, had it been pursued, would have gone to the underground Reich and to the Bormann organization. And if one examines the arming of Iraq, as we've looked at in, among other shows, For the Record 174, 248, and For the Record 347, the American role in arming Saddam Hussein was overseen by the elder George Bush in the 1980s. And one of the major points that I've been making in these broadcasts is that in my considered opinion, and I think the evidence is mounting, the Bush family is the point element for the Bormann organization and the underground Reich in the United States. In particular, the Bush links with the Thiessen economic interests and corporate interests are paramount in that regard. We're going to take a look at the Thiessen role in helping to arm Saddam Hussein later on in this program. Now, more about the German role in helping to equip the Iraqis with weapons of mass destruction. A more recent connection. Bear in mind that there's been much discussion and much reassurance that, in fact, if Iraq is attacked, that missiles will be able to shoot down any scuds or other projectiles that are aimed at Israel. I wouldn't bet on that one because I think one of the things that the underground Reich is aiming at here is to provoke the extermination of Israel, the destruction and or subjugation of the United States, a retaliatory Holocaust against the Arabs, and who will be left when the smoke clears. You can shoot down a Scud missile, but you can't shoot down an artillery shell. And in that context, consider the following. This is from the Wall Street Journal of Wednesday, October 9th of 2002. The following story is datelined Berlin. It's by David Crawford and Ian Johnson, and it's headlined, Iraq may have bought German arms technology. Prosecutors allege exporter in Mannheim sold gear for Canon via Jordan. And this reads in part as follows. German prosecutors say Iraq has acquired technology to make a long-range cannon capable of delivering atomic, biological, and chemical weapons, and that it came from Germany via Jordan. The allegation is in a report prepared by German military and police agencies for prosecutors in Mannheim, Germany. A court there is preparing to hear a case in January against two Germans who bought from German companies cannon boring equipment that allegedly ended up in Iraq. The investigation was initiated in January of 2001 after state auditors conducting a routine inspection discovered irregularities in the books of a Mannheim company, Alriwo GmbH, and that's pronounced capital A, that's spelled, I should say, capital A-L-R-I-W-O. I don't know how it's pronounced. Continuing, the investigation soon focused on Bernd Schumpeter, a 59-year-old Alriwo employee. Alriwo has shipped various products illegally to Iraq under the United Nations Oil for Food Program. Prosecutors say Mr. Schumpeter used the company to buy cannon boring equipment in 1999 and 2000 from two German companies. One was Birksmüller GmbH, based in northern Germany, which sold Mr. Schumpeter around about 189,000 euros, or $186,000, worth of drilling equipment. The other is Iftek GmbH, from which he bought about 50,000 euros worth of equipment. Prosecutors say Mr. Schumpeter also tried to buy four cannon tubes in 1999 from Swiss concern Parcom Aktiengesellschaft, but backed out of the deal when the company asked for an official Jordanian document assuring that the tubes would stay in Jordan. And, skipping down once again, Mr. Schumpeter was arrested last year and charged last month. When the trial begins in January, German intelligence is expected to show that that Jordan was only a transit point for the equipment. Prosecutors say the goods were purchased by a man they identify only as Sahib Al-H. They say the man is an Iraqi-born U.S. citizen based in Amman who shipped the goods to Iraq. Skipping down again. Although Iraq still has missiles capable of delivering atomic, biological, or chemical weapons, military experts say, the artillery project has been priority since the 1980s when the first Al-Faw prototype was produced. Quote, "Everyone talks about missiles, but missiles are very expensive," unquote, says Chris Foss, editor of Jane's Armor and Artillery. Again quoting, "Artillery like this is far cheaper and can be deployed much more quickly," unquote. Well, what we're going to look at next, actually what we're going to listen to next, is an excerpt from For the Record program number 155. And this is the last material apparently bequeathed to us by the late heroic Paul Manning, part of the CBS News team that covered the war in Europe, along with Edward R. Murrow, flew combat missions into Europe on a B-17, shot down an ME-109, was almost shot down himself, broadcast the surrender of Germany on the CBS radio network, then trained as a gunner aboard B-29s to cover the air raids into Japan, and broadcast a surrender of Japan from the deck of the United States Missouri. In 1991, a prestigious Israeli monthly called Monitor published an article based on Paul Manning's research and excerpting a book that he never got to publish, In Search of Martin Bormann. That book's publication was interdicted in part because of pressure on the corporations and in part because Paul Manning's son Jerry was murdered, according to Paul Manning's intelligence contacts, as part of the pressure on Paul Manning to avoid publishing this book. And in For the Record 155, from this article from Monitor magazine from early of 1991, Paul Manning discusses the Bormann organization's role along with Argentina and Egypt and Iraq in helping to acquire not only weapons of mass destruction but nuclear weapons and a missile program, the Condor missile, that could have delivered the weapons abroad. This, again, is from For the Record 155 from May of 1999. In my new book, I tell of my interview with Dr. Grunbaum, the German nuclear scientist who worked at the Nuclear Physics Institution in Karlsruhe. Grunbaum shared with me very accurate and amazing details of how West Germany signed several agreements with Argentina, and how, according to these agreements, Germany was able to join the exclusive, small club of the very few countries that have the ability to produce thermonuclear power. Dr. Grunbaum, again that's Grunbaum, provided me as well with exact details of the Bormann organization's activities and the ways this corporation sponsored nuclear activities. In order to check out and find out dates, places, and such information, I worked with Dr. Grunbaum in Strasbourg and in New York, too. I have to admit that I never witnessed before such a close surveillance as was done towards this man by German intelligence. One time, I had a call from him from Switzerland, and I could sense fear in his voice and discouragement. He told me that when he was in his hotel in Paris before he went to Switzerland, his notebook that he carried everywhere was stolen. It had recorded in it all the details about the development of German nuclear power in Argentina. Then, that same day, when he was passing from France to Switzerland at the border, his car was surrounded by French secret police agents. To his surprise, they searched and took apart his car, trying to find a copy of these notes that had been stolen. But he had a copy of these notes in Switzerland. In my eyes, this tale is not weird, for I have no doubt that elements in the French secret police that had been connected with the Nazi intelligence organization actually had their agents search the scientist's car. In a letter, in a later letter to me from Strasbourg, he wrote, quote, "I am sure the next time we both go to South America, I can point to you clearly the people of, the executives, and the major people of the Bormann organization. When the book is published, you will find detailed all the evidence for the facts you read in this article." By the way, as far as I know, again, the book was never published. Continuing with the text here, quoting Manning, "Friends of mine who were enemies of the Nazi ethic passed to me some telegrams that the U.S. intelligence were trying to take away. These messages had been sent from the secret offices of those concerned with Bormann in Bonn, Germany, to their branches in Argentina. One of these messages, that is dated October 18, 1990, says, quote, 'We plugged the leak,' unquote." It was on this date that Mrs. Leon Grunbaum responded to John Loftus's call by stating, quote, "Leon is dead." Also in the Monitor article, the Egyptian-Iraqi death connection. The participation of Egypt, along with the U.S. and Allied forces in the Persian Gulf War, helped the Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak show the world and make it believe that Saddam Hussein's ambitious plans to develop chemical and biological and nuclear power have nothing to do with the Egyptian scientists and their financial sources. Egypt preferred that none of the nuclear arms would be developed on its territory, since Israel is right next to it. That is why Iraq was chosen for that task. There were two important reasons for Mubarak's decision in this matter. Mubarak, it would seem, is showing an incredible personal sensitivity, an unusual one, about locations of nuclear facilities in Egypt. So great is his sensitivity that he even objected to the construction and use of nuclear power stations in Egypt. It seems that the Egyptian national trauma about the damage that could happen to the Aswan Dam is leading Mubarak's objections. The Egyptians are living in dread that one day the dam will collapse and the following horrible disaster will happen to the nation. The Nile will overflow and will wash out the entire delta and the major Egyptian cities along the Nile, a modern flood. Mubarak does not want to add any more to the trauma already there. However, the second reason is much more practical and is connected to Grunbaum's and Manning's story. That is, the German influence in Iraq was always very strong. By the way, the profound Nazi influence on Iraq and Saddam Hussein and the involvement of key German corporations, obviously at their foundation tied to the Bormann Group with the arming of Iraq, is discussed in a pair of half-hour segments entitled Uncle Sam and the Swastika Redux. Those are available from Spitfire. Returning now to discussion of the profound influence of Nazi Germany and contemporary Germany on Iraq. The Germans, for instance, were never fascinated, as were the British and the Americans, with Saudi Arabia. They were always drawn to Iraq. The high point of German influence in Iraq was during World War II. The Iraqis supported Hitler. Therefore, is it any wonder they support Saddam Hussein?
This support was so great that in 1941, Ali Rashid rebelled against the British, at that time governing Baghdad, in order to establish a pro-Nazi Iraqi regime. The rebellion failed, and Rashid and his allies fled to Nazi Germany. In the 1950s, when Nasser was in power in Egypt, Rashid found shelter in Egypt. Mubarak was aware of the deep and close relationship the Iraqis have with Germany. He hoped that these connections would give the Arabs the money and the technology to develop nuclear arms and missiles. The Germans, or according to Paul Manning, the Bormann Organization, were those who established the partnership between Argentina and the Iraqis and Egyptians to develop the Argentinian missile Condor II. The missile was developed by a German scientist who worked in Argentina's laboratories of the arms industry. It was the Egyptians and the Iraqis who named it Condor II. Since 1985, the Americans tried very hard to persuade the Argentinians to drop the missile project, but the Argentinians let the Americans know that the pressure had to be on Bonn, Germany. They said as well that when the development of the missile is complete, it will serve the German army as well as Argentina, Iraq, and Egypt. Confidential American pressure on Germany was unsuccessful. In early 1989, the Americans learned that the missile was just about complete, and German scientists were about to begin experimenting with it. At that point, the Americans let the Argentinian president, Carlos Menem, know in no uncertain terms that they would allow no production of the missile. Thereupon, Menem agreed to give up production of the missile and received in return a few hundred million dollars. For the Bormann people, it did not matter at all. They did not care whether Egypt or Iraq ended up with the missile, as long as its technology remained in German hands. In the early 1990s, an executive of the Israeli intelligence, the Mossad, was visiting the German council and presented to him up-to-date information about the involvement of German companies, most of them under the Bormann Organization's control, in the development and manufacture of Egyptian and Iraqi chemical, biological, and nuclear arms. And by the way, there's discussion of just that in the aforementioned pair of half-hour segments entitled Uncle Sam and the Swastika Redux, in which I talk about many of the key German corporations, including the Thyssen complex, and their involvement with the arming of Iraq, and those companies inevitably at their foundation joined two of the remarkable and deadly Bormann Organization. Continuing. Resuming again with this last sentence, in the early 1990s, an executive of the Israeli intelligence, the Mossad, was visiting the German consul and presented to him up-to-date information about the involvement of German companies, most of them under the Bormann Organization's control, in the development and manufacture of Egyptian and Iraqi chemical, biological, and nuclear arms. The consul looked through the papers for a couple of minutes, then handed them back to the Israeli, saying, "I do not believe it. This cannot be true," unquote. Now, just imagine what would have happened if the Iraqis had had not only the Scud missiles, but also the new, modern Condor II. Not only would Saddam Hussein have been happier, but also the Bormann people. That, again, an article from early 1991 from the Israeli publication Monitin, forwarded to me by Peter Manning, Paul Manning's son, and translated again by Mr. Jack Sparks and Mr. Ozzie Zuckerman of Central Synagogue in New York City. That, again, from For the Record program number 155 from May of 1999. Now, in February of 1998, we touched on the subject of the equipping of Iraq with its weapons of mass destruction, and we accessed a list of corporations and entities that were being sued in a class action suit by veterans of the Gulf War in 1991, this in connection with the arming of Saddam Hussein and the equipping of him with his weapons of mass destruction, and in connection with the Gulf War syndrome, which was afflicting and has afflicted so many veterans, not only American, but British as well, of the Gulf War. And as we'll see in the second side, civilians in the area were affected as well.
A nurse named Joyce Riley, who was treating Gulf War veterans and who contracted Gulf War syndrome herself, accessed a list of corporations that in turn were being sued by Gulf War veterans in the lawsuit I alluded to. And in this list of some 83 different corporate entities, most of them are German and many of them are subsidiaries of one type or another of the Thyssen-Aktiengesellschaft firm. The Thyssen firm, now ThyssenKrupp, is one of the pivotal elements of the Bormann organization. Again, from For the Record number 87, recorded in February of 1998, note the many Thyssen connections to the arming of Iraq.
Turning to the list of companies being sued by the Gulf War veterans, this is a list of 83 defendants. Number 39 is Thyssen AG, German company. Number 40, Thyssen Incorporated, obviously an American subsidiary, Delaware Corporation, primary place of business in Texas. Number 41 is the Budd Company, that's capital B-U-D-D, Foreign Corporation Home Office in Michigan. Keep that in mind, we're going to come back to the Budd Corporation. By the way, not to confuse with the brewing company. Number 42 is Thyssen Specialty Steels Incorporated, Foreign Corporation Home Office in Illinois. Skipping down to number 45, Thyssen Steel Group, Delaware Corporation, registered agent in Texas. Number 47, Thyssen Stahl AG, German company. 48, Thyssen Aktiengesellschaft, German company. 49, Thyssen Rheinstahl Technik, GmbH, German company. 50, Thyssen Handelsunion AG, German company. 51, Thyssen Industry AG, German company. 52, Thyssen Industry Aktiengesellschaft, German company. 53, Thyssen Maschinenbau, German company. Obviously, these are all subsidiaries of Thyssen AG. That is the name for Vereinigte Stahlwerke, the company, one of the three giant cartels that grew up in Germany as a result of the Dawes and Young Plan and that helped to support Hitler politically and then elevated Hitler to the position, or actually provided the backbone of German war-making industry. Now, as I read that list of the various Thyssen subsidiaries that are being sued by the Gulf War veterans, bear in mind that one of the companies I mentioned was the Budd Company, Foreign Corporation Home Office in Michigan. The Budd Company was purchased by, surprise, surprise, Thyssen AG. Turning once again to the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, of Thyssen's purchase of Budd, we read, in January of 1978, these two lead banks, acting through the UBS DB Corporation, an American firm of the Union Bank of Switzerland and the Deutsche Bank of Germany, would be the financial advisors for Thyssen AG in its $275 million cash takeover of the Budd Company of Troy, Michigan, a leading U.S. manufacturer of auto components, truck trailers, and rail cars. UBS DB Corporation would also say that the West German companies it represented were showing a, quote, very substantial interest in all sorts of American ventures, including mergers and acquisitions, unquote. So again, please note that Thyssen AG, that company and many of its subsidiaries and proprietary companies comprising a nice chunk of the companies that are being sued as defendants by the Gulf War veterans in their class action suit. Bear in mind there are a total of 83 defendants in that particular suit.
That, again, from For the Record number 87. There will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record number 384 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. That's at www.spitfirelist.com. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows are available for download only on a longer URL linked to both the Spitfire and WFMU.org Dave Emery website. You can reach Spitfire at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 384, Between Iraq and a Hard Place, Part 4, being recorded on October 20th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.